Northwestern University, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Reviewing Stand. Northwestern University is celebrating its centennial year, 100 years of service to the nation and the great Northwest. Today, The Reviewing Stand discusses by transcription, does advertising provide a better way of life? Our unrehearsed give-and-take discussion will center around the economic function of advertising, the ethical responsibility of the advertiser, and the checks now imposed on advertising. Now our moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, will introduce participants in today's discussion. Mr. McBurney.
Our speakers today are T.T. Byrd, Vice President, Sales, the Iron Fireman Manufacturing Company, John C. Maddox, Assistant to the President, Fuller and Smith and Roth, Incorporated, National Advertising Agency, and Dr. Richard Wallen, Professor of Psychology at Cleveland College of Western Reserve University. Now, gentlemen, does advertising provide a better way of life? Maddox, what is the fundamental economic function of advertising? How would you state that, too?
Well, increased productivity and consumer income and a rising standard of living in our system, I think, depend very largely on capital investment. Advertising stimulates the demand from consumers, which justified this investment. And to that extent, advertising has contributed to a rising standard of living. And I think advertising makes an outstanding contribution to our common welfare because it promotes a dynamic, expanding economy. I think advertising is an integral part of our business system in which businessmen are trying constantly to find new products and new features for these products, features that consumers will want. And without an opportunity to profit fairly quickly from these new products and features, businessmen wouldn't look very hard to find them, and they wouldn't risk their money in putting them on the market. Advertising is a tool which permits development of profitable demand.
You go along with that, Wallen?
No, I don't, McBurney. Maddox's point is denied, I think, by history, because there have been many researches and developments that go ahead even before advertising reached its present state. Maddox's point is that you wouldn't get research and development in products unless you had advertising. Well, I think the steam engine and the boat and many of our great inventions come not from advertising, but from interested people who are curious about things.
What do you think, Bert?
Well, in my estimation, advertising is primarily to acquaint the people of America with the things that are available, to keep production up, to keep demand up, to keep employment up.
Well, now, you were saying that it's a substance, that advertising is a link between mass production and mass distribution. I take it you think it's a necessary link.
Well, I think it's vital to keeping the whole economic system spinning, because advertising makes possible mass production. Mass production makes possible lower prices. The lower prices are, the more people can use them. And the more people can use them, the more people are employed. And it goes around in a circle.
Now, do you care to press your objection, Warren?
Well, I simply want to say that mass production has its disadvantages as well as its advantages. And if Maddox is going to claim that advertising promotes mass production, he also will have to say that advertising is in part responsible for the disadvantages that accrue from mass production.
I agree.
I can't understand any disadvantages to mass production, Mr. Wallen.
One of the simplest of those is that the individual worker has lost all sense of creativity and pride of craft in his activity as a result of mass production.
Well, I take exception to that. In America, we have workers who are enjoying an abundant life because of mass production, because of the demand of the nation.
But you're defining an abundant life as meaning a matter of economic goods, teacher comforts, and so on. I'm thinking about a matter of one's own self-esteem. And sociological findings bear me out that over and over again, our workers in this country have lost a sense of individuality.
Well, I disagree with that. The self-esteem, we certainly have that in America. What other country in the world has more self-esteem than we have in America?
Maddox, I agree with Wallen that one of the big problems that we have to face in this country is the problem of the lack of identification of the worker in a mass production industry with his community as a person of significant meaning. And that's the problem that we have to live, but it's with us. Saying that advertising is a part of the cause of it doesn't mean that the advertising isn't good for many other things. And the same people that are working on advertising to promote consumer demand are now beginning to give their attention to the problems of the workers in mass industry who need more significance to their jobs.
I just can't go along at all with this comment about the worker in America losing his identity in mass production. If the American worker isn't an individualist in this country, what country would he be an individualist in?
It is that he is rapidly losing that. Studies of the Yankee City series by the sociologist at the University of Chicago demonstrate this conclusively. It's an important cause of labor-management conflict. But I would go along with Maddox that advertising is not solely responsible for it, that it is only one part of the total cog that keeps our industry functioning in this particular way.
Well, there is a question, certainly, how large business should get. As a matter of fact, I remember discussing that question on this Northwestern University reviewing thing some months ago. I want to explore your line of reasoning a bit further, if I may, Maddox. You have made the point earlier that advertising is especially essential in a society where free choice operates. Now, what do you mean by free choice, and what's your point there?
Well, it goes further than just advertising and business from my point of view. In our whole society here in this country, we operate as individuals more than probably any other country in the world. And that applies to our political action as well as our action in the marketplace. Now, in order for us to act collectively as individuals for our common good, we must be able to operate freely as individuals, politically and in choosing goods. Advertising has to put in front of the American people a wide choice of goods of the products of our factories, which they can accept or reject as they see fit. And therefore, the people as a whole are deciding what is good for them and what is not.
And you make the assumption that they have a free choice in selecting goods in the marketplace, and that advertising contributes to that freedom of choice.
Well, freedom of choice is a relative thing, of course. Compared to what they had to choose from 50 years ago, the choice is almost infinite today. But there are certain economic limits within industry which may narrow the freedom of choice within a certain kind of good.
I would want to make the point that it is not simply having a large number of goods to choose from that permits freedom of choice, but that it is having adequate grounds to base your choice on. And I would like to ask Maddox whether he thinks that advertising has been trying to provide the consumer with the grounds on which to make choices among these various kinds of goods.
Well, I think each advertiser is a biased advocate of his good.
That's understandable.
He does not operate in the social sense. He's not aware of the social implications of what he does. He tries to sell the goods that he has, and he presents what features he can within the limited means available in advertising space to get that done.
You accept that point of view, Bert?
Well, I want to make this comment, Mr. McBurney. Talking about selling the goods, I feel that the average concern sells what the goods will do, not the goods as such, but the advantages of the goods, the end result.
I can give a very good example of my point about the lack of free choice in the case of glue. Most people know a certain brand of glue because it's been highly advertised. It happens not to be the best brand of glue that's available, as shown by actual laboratory tests. Now, this is the kind of thing that can happen. The big advertiser can squeeze out the small independent businessman, and that's exactly what has been happening, by virtue of a big advertising budget that carries his message. But he may not have a product which is the best product available. Therefore, the consumer does not actually have freedom of choice.
Would you say that by and large, in the marketplace, as a result of relatively free choice in advertising, the best merchandise generally emerges?
I think perhaps generally it emerges, particularly in those things which are bought frequently enough that people have a chance to shop around a bit. But I think there are many, many instances where the best merchandise does not emerge as being the merchandise which is most highly advertised.
I disagree with Mr. Wallen's statement to the effect that big business has been squeezing out the small business. We have all over For instances of where small business has grown to become large, substantial business. In a free America like this, everyone has an equal opportunity. All businesses started small. I can point to our own concern, started in a very small way. We have grown steadily through effort and ingenuity and aggressiveness.
I think this freedom of opportunity is a phrase that can easily get in our way, and I would hesitate to say that we've bettered our way of life and freedom of opportunity by advertising. What chance does a man have who's starting off with a good product, perhaps better than any in his field, if he's faced with a competitor who has $1 million a year advertising budget and can carry his communication nationwide?
If his product is good enough, the tools of advertising will give enough assurance for investors to back him, and he can get it.
Absolutely, I agree with that, and I point to our own case again.
I'd like to make a point in this connection. Consumer research publications of various sorts have tripled their subscription, the number of subscribers, since World War II. Now, this is the only source of information that I know of where you can actually find out about products irrespective of the size of the advertising budget they have.
Many of the more progressive manufacturers and advertisers today are putting on their merchandise that they display in stores what they call informative labels, which has grown out of the consumer movement, in which they detail all the technical information that's necessary to know about the product. That has been very successful, by the way. I know one large consumer has carried that on for quite a few years.
Now, before we continue this debate, gentlemen, remember we're speaking to the question, does advertising provide a better way of life? We've had several oblique definitions of what constitutes a better way of life. I think Berg is thinking of it in terms of national prosperity. Wallen here has had a word to say about it. Now, let me put the question directly to you, Mr. Berg. Does advertising contribute to national prosperity?
He's very gentle.
Assuming for the moment that national prosperity has something to do with a better way of life, how does it do?
In my estimation, advertising over the years and the sales effort of the businessman of America has done much to build up our present way of life. This industrial organization that we have covering the nation that's given employment to 65 million people. Back in the early days, the needs of the American public was very small. Their wants were small. And along came the so-called Yankee salesman with his ingenuity. He started making products and started advertising them, selling them, and selling them in such volume against all forms of resistance. I'm referring to sewing machines and automobiles, vacuum cleaners, washing machines, and 101 other things. He sold them in such volume that plants had to be built, covering acres, storage high. Not only that, but automatic machinery had to be designed to install in these plants to produce this stuff in volume that the American public were buying.
Well, now, is this kind of employment, 65 million, a good index to talk about?
Well, in my estimation, it is the index. You rate the prosperity of the country not by the price of stocks in Wall Street or the money in banks or the natural resources of the country. You rate prosperity, in my humble feeling, by the number of people employed. We have some 65 million people employed today. Back in the Depression years, it was down to 35 million. If we can keep 65 million people employed, we'll have prosperity in America, in my estimation, for years and years and forever.
Your colleagues are anxious to get a word in here, but I have one more question for you before we move on. Is prosperity a good index of a better way of life?
Well, I think so. Of course, what do you mean by a better way of life? Life, are you talking about...
Well, that's really my question.
Are you talking about the commercial things of life, or...
That's what you're talking about, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Uh-huh.
There are certain kinds of things that are called commercial, which are almost necessary for a better way of life you find in any way that you choose. Many commercial things are not. But it is perfectly true that people who are underfed, who are who do not have adequate clothing, who don't know where their next penny is coming from, can hardly learn how to be cooperative, to be kindly, to be centered in humanitarian values. And in this sense, I think general prosperity defined as a good chance for everybody to get the basic necessities of life and a little bit more, does contribute to what might be called a better way of living.
And certainly a better way of living, so defined in terms of national prosperity, is not incompatible with securing other values.
Not at all.
Particularly so when prosperity means more real income, that is, more surplus of income above that required for the necessities of life, and at the same time, shorter working hours. The drudgery has been reduced through the invention of labor-saving machines in the home, and they have more time to spend on developing the finer things, and they have more money to buy them with.
In my estimation, in America, we have the finest nation on earth because of this industrial empire that we have in America. And our job, as I see it, is to keep the wheels of industry turning in America. These wheels, in my estimation, are made up of, let's say, sales and jobs and purchasing power. Sales makes jobs, and jobs makes purchasing power, and purchasing power makes for more sales. And the gears continue to turn. Industry continues to operate. The driving force is sales. People buying things, people wanting things, people wanting automobiles and vacuum cleaners and washing machines and all the wants and needs of life. And as long as they keep on buying, well, people will produce. And as long as people produce, they will be paid well. And as long as they're paid well, they'll have purchasing power. And as long as they have purchasing power, they'll continue to buy.
Now, in